The idea of emotional intelligence has gripped the business world's imagination since Daniel Goleman's book introduced the concept a quarter of a century ago. However, despite the case for emotional intelligence being generally well understood amongst leaders, the knowing-doing gap is wide. Why? One reason is that many available tools are simply too rational, probably because they pander to the skepticism and fear of genuinely embracing our feelings. But in going straight to a logic-based interpretation of emotions, we lose the entire point of emotional intelligence. That's kind of ironic. The case for developing emotional intelligence is proven that high EQ results in greater productivity and better leadership, dramatically more than having high IQ. So the way emotional intelligence is often taught encourages a sort of anti-emotional intelligence, kidding ourselves that because we understand the concept, we also embody the intelligence. These are in fact worlds apart. Another reason may be that the shadow side of our personality blocks us from seeing how our emotions play out in our reasoning and relationships. This is a deeper problem, not something a half-day workshop will solve. In this show, Scott moves into the guest seat and we talk to him about his new book, where he tackles these challenges to find a new way of building our emotional intelligence.
Hey folks, welcome to the Evolving Leader Podcast. I'm Scott Allender, co-host of the show, but today I'm going to slide over into the guest seat and see what it feels like to be grilled by the relentless John Gomes and the wonderful Emma Sinclair. So I'm going to hand over to you and put on my guest hat now.
Thank you, Scott. Welcome to the Evolving Leader.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
This is a new experience for you. Before we dive in, Emma, welcome back to the hosting seat. It's always great to have you here. How are you feeling today?
Thanks, John. Thank you very much, Scott. I am feeling very ready for this conversation. I've been looking forward to it for a little while. So I'm feeling quite calm, quite relaxed, but also very intrigued to hear Mr. Scott Allender in the guest seat. How are you feeling, John?
I'm feeling playful and very appreciative that we're having this chance to talk to Scott. And I'm filled with anticipation to get to talk to our friend about his new book, The Enneagram of Emotional Intelligence, A Journey to Personal and Professional Success. In addition to being co-host of this podcast, Scott is a certified emotional intelligence coach and Enneagram teacher. In his new book, he brings together these two systems to evolve our understanding of what emotional intelligence really is and how to finally cultivate the awareness we all need for success and well-being. Scott, welcome to the show, to the guest seat on The Evolving Leader. How are you feeling today?
I'm feeling mostly the exact opposite of Emma. I'm feeling a little nervous to be sat over here, not relaxed at all. It's an interesting transition to go from host to guest, but I'm excited to be able to talk to you about the book. So thanks for making space for this.
Brilliant. Well, as I was preparing months, actually, for this show today, it's occurred to me that for all the times we sat together in front of these microphones on the show, we haven't really shared much with our audience about our own personal backgrounds. Well, I've done a bit. This feels like the perfect place to start. Can you share with our listeners a bit about your personal background and what led you to procuring your various certifications in these psychometrics and personality systems?
Yeah. So I've been working in the L&D space for quite some time with an affinity, as you would know, that I care about leadership disproportionately probably over most things, because I just deeply believe in its importance. And the approach that I've wanted to take, one of the approaches is to work with leaders to help them raise their awareness, because I've seen so many well-intentioned, good leaders have unintentional, unfortunate consequences with some of their blind spots. And so as part of doing that, I set off to pursue various tools that I could put into my toolkit and, you know, work with them. So I pursued, I got a certification in Myers-Briggs and in Hogan and in the EQ 2.0 system. And then along the way, for about a decade now, I've been working with the Enneagram and primarily just for myself. I've found with all the benefits, with all these tools that I use, I found nothing to be as personally transformative as the Enneagram. So more recently, I've been trying to bring Enneagram work into organizational context. It's a little tougher to do with that system than Myers-Briggs. You know, you can teach a Myers-Briggs session in 3 hours and get pretty good mileage out of it. The Enneagram is far more complex, which is partly why I like it, because people are quite complex. So you can understand it at a high level rather quickly, but it takes a bit of time to dig deep into it. And I know, I think it was in season two, we had my friend Ian Cron on, and we did talk a little bit about the Enneagram with him. But yeah, so I set out to write this book to kind of marry up the emotional intelligence system with the Enneagram.
Scott, I would love to, in a minute, dive into why you've written this book. But I wonder, just for the listeners as well, I know you've mentioned Enneagram on the show before, but I wonder if you could just give us a little overview of what it is. What are we working with today, if that's possible?
Yeah. So the Enneagram is a personality typology that's a simplistic overview, but basically what it is it reveals 9 primary archetypes, personality archetypes, and the often hidden motivations and fears and desires that operate and fuel the behaviors of each of those 9 types. So whereas a Myers-Briggs might give you insight into preferences, and a Hogan tool or tools like it might give you insight into how people might experience you, the Enneagram is really not about what you do, but why you do it. So the best way to think of it is it gets into motivations, and those motivations are often in the shadows of our awareness, right? They're in the blind spots. They're things that we don't see, and that we don't see that we don't see. And so the Enneagram is to help you understand these latent sort of drivers in your day-to-day behaviors and how you frame the world and how you see things, how you think about things, how you feel about things. These personalities, from an Enneagram perspective, is one way to look at it is to think of the root word persona, which in Greek translation means mask. So our personalities are comprised of all sorts of things, right? We've got natural temperament, there's epigenetics, there's genetics, there's a lot of things that form our personality structures. And then we have these lived experiences. And in those lived experiences, we learn what is my unconscious strategy for getting my needs met. So we have a lived experience where we go, okay, this is what's valued in my world here, in my family system. This is what's not valued. This is how I'm going to get rewarded. This is how I'm not going to get rewarded. And we begin to layer on these personas. And many of these layers are there to defend against the authentic self, the truest parts of who we are. And over time, we end up over-identifying with these masks at the expense of our truest, most vulnerable, authentic selves. And so whether you're, now there's 9 types, as I mentioned, each one of these 9 types is sort of 9 different kinds of masks that we wear, and people over-identify and then get stuck on that type. So we're meant to sort of contain all 9 types, but because of our lived experience, we sort of stick somewhere. So the Enneagram reveals a whole bunch to us about what it's like to be in that type, why we're in that type, the stories behind that type, and then also how to get out of being stuck there, right? The Enneagram really is meant, and it doesn't get used this way very often, and this is why it gets complex to use in organizational context, is because the Enneagram ultimate journey is to start to set you on a path to move beyond the limitations of your type.
Thank you very much, Scott. And I have to admit, I've been diving into Enneagram with conversations with yourself, but also reading your books just opens your eyes to a very different way of understanding and exploring self. And I wonder whether we could start there, because you start with a very powerful, very personal story at the beginning of your book into kind of your journey and almost an awakening of self and how Enneagram's given you that access point. So I wonder if you could just explain to us why this book, why now, and why is it so important for you?
Yeah, so there's a personal and professional motivation for doing this. Personally, I had been studying the Enneagram for a while, and a friend of mine was working on his PhD, and part of the work he was doing was around emotions. And in that, he gathered sort of 12 of his willing friends to be kind of part of an experiment he was doing on, can he help men change the conversation around feelings and the way we relate to our own feelings and the way we relate to each other with our emotions. And day one, I knew a few people in the room. I didn't know most people. He wrote 8 core emotions up on the wall that was based on the psychologist Chip Dodd's 8 core emotions model. And all you had to do was look up at the wall and in a popcorn fashion, no order, just identify one or two feelings you were feeling, no context, no explanation, just say it. And I couldn't name it. This wasn't even emotional granularity like we've talked about on the show before, John. This was like just basic, right? Just pick one. And nobody would even know if you were telling the truth. Just say one, right? Just do it. And I couldn't do it. And finally, I went last and I chose loneliness because that was one of the emotions. And I felt lonely because I felt like the only one that couldn't name it. So that set me off that night to do a deeper dive into some Enneagram research. And I finally, up until that point, wasn't quite sure what my type was, and I read the Complete Enneagram by Beatrice Chestnut, and in that book she gets into something known as subtypes, which I don't get into in my book. And when I finally got to my type, I'm like, oh my gosh, she's had a nanny camera in my house my whole life. Like, this is like reading again. It was like a journey into the forest of blind of the shadows of like all the stuff that I hadn't seen or wanted to see. And it showed me why I was so good at using emotions to understand what other people were probably feeling, but so bad at identifying what I was feeling. Around that same time, I was driving down the interstate a few weeks later, I think it was. And I'd started to experience out of the blue what felt like potentially some kind of cardiac episode. And I'd never experienced anything like that before. I was short of breath and I wasn't really feeling pain. So I didn't know what it was, but my heart was just moving really, really erratically. And I started to hyperventilate a little bit. And again, never having experienced anything like this before, I started to make my way to the exit that I saw and started dialing emergency services on myself and pulled over into a parking lot. And by the time the ambulance arrived, I was out of the car and I was pacing around. And my heart sort of settled into a better rhythm. And I realized probably not a cardiac event. So probably something you hear about that's related to anxiety. And I wasn't quite sure, but by the end of that evening, I was quite clear that I had had my first ever panic attack. And in that moment, I knew I was scratching the surface of probably what was the same challenge as I explained in my previous example with the men's group. I had a bunch of feelings that were trapped inside that I wasn't connected to that needed to find their way out. And my body just sounded an alarm. And it was like, you need to wake up to your own emotional experience. So that set me on the path of pursuing this Enneagram certification, which includes a lot of personal work. You know, I got back in therapy and started working with a coach and started doing all sorts of stuff to try to get more connected to my own emotional experience. So that's the personal motivation for why, you know, working with the Enneagram has been so important for me, because I'm so much more able now, not always, but so much more consistently able to connect with myself and find my emotional experience, which is why I love, that we start this podcast every week with a, you know, how are you feeling? That's such an important question in my life. So that's the personal reason. And tomorrow I'll probably have a vulnerability hangover for sharing all that with you. But the professional reason is for all that we know about the importance of emotional intelligence, right? There's so many studies happening about how emotional intelligence and emotional intelligence related activities are far more important than somebody's expertise, skills, experience, IQ. And yet, collectively, I don't think we're getting very far with it, right? You've all read Tasha Yurick's book, Insight, and in the study that they did, and they revealed that only, you know, the cornerstone of emotional intelligence, self-awareness, that only like 13 to 15% of people are actually self-aware. And the more self-aware you think you are, the opposite is likely to be true. And so I'm thinking to myself, we've got all these measures. I'm certified in one of these tools. I work with people in this space, and we're not really making progress. And so for me, going back to my description of the Enneagram personalities as these sort of nine different masks that we wear, I started thinking about, I think the issue is we know all the stuff about emotional intelligence. We know what it looks like. And so we start working with people to try to help them hone in on it. But people don't know they're wearing a mask of personality. So we end up basically trying to say, you need to adjust your mask. You need more blush on the mask. You need better eyeliner on the mask, right? You need a little more of this and a little less of this on the mask. And so people might make some little adjustments, but it's not really sustainable. When stress and pressure and things are, you know, triggers happen, it doesn't last, right? And by the way, in these sort of you according to you evaluations, because people take an emotional intelligence assessment based on what they know of themselves or think they know of themselves, and they get the results back, and they're really, I never experienced anybody being surprised by any of the results. They already kind of know where their challenges are, but they don't have the toolkit or the ability to make lasting, sustainable change. So the idea is, let's take what we know is proven and studied and validated around emotional intelligence, and let's use the Enneagram to excavate and go deeper. Let's get inside of what's really happening. So that was my twofold reason why I wanted to write this book.
I don't think you need to have a vulnerability hangover tomorrow. I think
okay,
sort of like hopefully you'll feel better about yourself. I think the more we kind of come to terms with these things, the more we can grow. There are lots of definitions out there of emotional intelligence and interpretations of it, because it has become quite a big idea that's grown and grown and grown. How do you define it?
Yeah, so the sort of at a high level, people often talk about the Daniel Goleman model in his original book, which is the quadrants of self-awareness, self-management, awareness of others, and relationship management. And when you zoom in a little closer, you see things like self-regulation and motivation and empathy and social skills, you know, all of which are true and useful. In the system that I work with, the EQI 2.0, it looks at five composite scales, which are self-perception, self-expression, interpersonal relationships, decision-making, and stress management. So that's the framework I used in the book to explore all the nine types and how they show up to these traits. But beyond that, I think there's a couple things missing from the emotional intelligence conversation. And John, you and I have talked about this. All of these systems tend to get far too rational and logical far too quickly and bypass the actual emotional experience, which is what I did most of my life, right? I can talk about emotions. I understand what emotions are. I understand the value of emotions, but I wasn't really connected because I would get far too rational and heady about my emotions. So to really understand and become more emotionally intelligent, we first have to allow ourselves and find ways, if it's a struggle for you, to really feel your feelings. The other piece of it, and we've explored this a lot on the show, and I know it's a fundamental cornerstone for your work, John, on mindsets, which is bodily awareness, right? So we have our feelings, but our feelings are often constructed based on what's going on in our body and the quality of our thoughts. And so what the Enneagram actually reveals, you know, you have these nine types, but if you break the nine types down into three sections, you've got three types that are naturally over-identify and overuse cognitive intelligence, logical and rational intelligence. You've got three that are in what's called the gut or the body triad of intelligence, and they overuse and over-identify with the gut and the body. And then you've got the heart center in the Enneagram model that is all around emotions, and they kind of over-identify and overuse emotions. And what I look at in the book is we need to bring all three of these back into balance, because we have these natural proclivities to use one of those dominant intelligences, but it's only when we can bring the body and the head and the heart back working together that we really can cultivate emotional intelligence.
You mention this concept of the true self and the denied self, and I wonder what some of the signs are that indicate your true self is being denied. How does denying our true self actually hurt us or hold us back from future success?
Yeah, good question. So I talked about the nine, that there's nine core motivations for each type. And when we're in what's called quote unquote personality or our egos, or as I said, when we're fully, embracing the mask, the Enneagram system reveals to us that we've got these associated emotional vices with our personality type. So, and they're also called the passion of the type. And it's not passion like, passionate about going golfing or passionate about eating donuts. John, I'm passionate about eating donuts. It's really like, I think of it like a crime of passion. It's the dominant emotional experience that takes over and informs all of our other emotional experiences. So it starts to reveal to us that much of our emotional experiences are actually conditioned in us based on these sort of personality strategies that we have. And what they're masking is, as I mentioned earlier, the more authentic part of ourselves. So each Enneagram type also has what's called the virtue of the type, and the work of the Enneagram pushes us back towards reclaiming the virtue or that sort of lost parts of ourselves, that sort of hidden part of ourselves I keep referencing. So I can quickly just kind of go around and try to illustrate without taking too much explanation. But for type one on the Enneagram, the passion for one is anger. They're known as the improver or the perfectionist of the Enneagram. And the story they carry is that that I'm not good enough and the world's not good enough, and I have to set about perfecting it and improving it and improving myself. So they set this very high internal standard for what is considered good, and it's an impossible standard to reach. And so there's this constant like battle of anger inside, which, by the way, for this type, they don't think that anger is an acceptable emotion. So they try to hide it. And so it seeps out of them as this sort of resentment. And what they're resenting is that they themselves and others aren't achieving this internalized, self-imposed, high standard of what good is. And they self-deceive into thinking, if I can be good enough, if I could achieve enough good, if I can make the world around me good enough, I will actually reclaim the virtue, which is serenity. And that's where the passion of the type is deceiving everybody, because they will never get to serenity by trying to make everything perfect. They will only reclaim serenity when they let go of that false narrative that they're not good enough and that they have to make things perfect. And you can go through each type, right? So twos, they've got the passion of pride, and the virtue is humility. And the pride is that they have this story that says, I'm afraid that I'm not liked or needed or wanted. And so I'm going to set about trying to please people and seduce other people and help other people enough that they will mirror back to me enough appreciation that I will then feel like needed and wanted. And I almost pridefully set about trying to do it, inserting myself into things that I wasn't asked to be in, and believing that I know the best way to help and to offer advice and all of those things. And if you don't thank me for it, then I'm going to experience this rejection and this anger. The humility comes when they realize not everything's mine to do. I am liked. I am needed. I am wanted. And I don't have to set about trying to please and seduce everybody. And so I won't go through that, the example of the rest of the seven types, but for each type, so when one is experiencing a lot of anger, when twos are in pride, when threes are inauthenticity, when fours, you'd have to read the book to understand fuller descriptions, but when fours are experiencing envy, when fives are experiencing avarice, when sixes are experiencing a great deal of fear, when sevens are in gluttony, and when eights are in lust, and when nines are in sloth, these are all indicators that we are not living in our true selves. We are living out of the personality. We're living out of the ego. And when you're in that space, this is exactly why I think emotional intelligence work often fails, is because when those things, which are all consuming for each of the nine personality types, are in charge, there's no way you can make enough adjustments to live a more, you know, balanced life that is more fruitful for everybody around you, because you have the story behind the mask that's fueling the passion that's going to overtake everything else, right? So as you study the Enneagram and as you get to know your own type and what the passion or the vice is for you in your personality, you then start to do the work of how do I release the false story behind this narrative, and then I can start to reclaim, you know, the lost and hidden parts.
What's so interesting about the approach you've taken is that none of these models provides the whole answer. And what you've done is you kind of triangulated between the Enneagram and these five different components of emotional intelligence, plus these stories that bring them to life that are so eloquently told. Can you just dig into the these five emotional intelligence measures and how they sort of unlock some of the insights behind the Enneagram?
Yeah. So I look at self-perception, self-expression, interpersonal relationships, decision-making, and how we understand and deal with stress. And it's called stress management in the book, which I hate. And the only reason I used that title is because that's the language of the system. But in reality, I don't think of stress, you know, making progress against living an overstressed life is not to learn to simply manage it. Not that I'm saying that's what everybody means when they say stress management, but I really think it's about building a greater capacity for handling stressful situations. And that's really what I try to get at the book. But these are all interrelated. So self-perception, let's start there. Each of these nine personality archetypes have a natural and often false sense of self. We don't see ourselves very clearly, right? Now, I've been picking on ones for a minute, so just to carry that through, like ones may have the worst self-perception of any type because of this narrative that they've got to be perfect. They can't make mistakes. They're going to always see themselves as failing and making mistakes, right? And then that leads to a self-expression of, as we talked about a moment ago, falseness, right? Putting out there the appearance of being good and happy and cheerful when they're not really that way, or a sort of bubbling sense of irritability and resentment that leaks out that they're not aware of, that makes people feel that they're tense and hard to please. And so that self-perception leads to self-expression issues, and then that leads to interpersonal relationship challenges where they might seem rigid and unrelenting and difficult for them to sit in gray areas and maybe, you know, relax a little bit, and therefore their interpersonal relationships suffer. And this might lead to a challenge with decision-making, because if you think there's only one right way of doing things, only one way that's good and one way that's bad, you know, dealing with complex issues and making complex, nuanced decisions is going to be a challenge, right? You might be too rigid. And you might find that you're carrying a whole lot of stress and tension in your body because you're never living up to these impossibly high standards that you've set for yourself. And that is true for each of the nine types. So what the book does is try to get at, how do we get more clarity in all these areas? How do I start to see myself really more clearly, more compassionately, right? More openly. And then how can that help inform the way I express myself, and my interpersonal relationships will benefit, and my decision-making will benefit, and my capacity and ability to handle stresses and release stresses will greatly improve. So that's kind of the big middle section of the book is a detailed examination of how we do that.
Hi folks, Phil Kirby here, producer of the show. If you're enjoying The Evolving Leader and would like to stay connected with us between episodes, follow us on Twitter at evolving_leader. And please do leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We really appreciate your support. Thanks for listening.
Towards the end of the book, Scott, you start a whole chapter on the work of transformation and this sort of space of real personal growth work. And in there, you identify sort of 9 types of fear and state that, you know, acknowledging our fear is essential for developing awareness. Can you just unpack that sentence for us? What are you getting at there?
Yeah. So as you do the work of understanding your personality archetype, the tendencies, the sort of way we put the way we frame things, the lenses we put on things, underneath all of that. So even the vice we were talking about, the passion we were talking about, it's all motivated by this core fear that is often very hidden from consciousness. Most people would not say, in fact, a lot of times people resist it when you say, well, this is the core fear of that type. And they're like, what are you talking about? I don't feel that. And it's not till sometime later that they actually can acknowledge that that's what's going on. And so part of the growth work is to have the courage to face that fear, to confront the fear. And when I say by courage, a couple reasons. One is to do that means you have to also confront some of the wounding messages and childhood stories that sit behind that fear. It also means that you're going to open yourself up to real change potentially. But even the best people in our lives kind of don't want us to change, right? Like 7s who are known as the enthusiast on the Enneagram and tend to show up to every party you possibly have because they have tremendous amount of fear of missing out. And they're great storytellers usually, and they're a lot of fun. And part of what's motivating them though is that they're trying to outrun any sense of suffering or pain in life. And so they're always living in the future. They're always running really fast. They're overly optimistic. They are subject to confirmation bias because they don't want to look at anything that would slow them down or give them a dose of reality that doesn't feel optimistic and enthusiastic. If they start doing growth work and slow down a little bit and get connected with what they're trying to outrun and let a little bit of pain into their lives, knowing that sometimes pain is actually serves a purpose, they might not show up to your party next time you invite them, and they may not be overly enthusiastic. And you're going to be like, what's happened to you? Like, come on, come to the party and bring, like, you're even you who might, you know, be best friends with them are going to unintentionally, if you're not careful, hinder them from their real growth. So this is a critical part of using the Enneagram for growth and transformation, is that we have to eventually get to this place of confronting the fear and what was the message and story behind that fear in terms of why I adopted it and held on to it and allowed it to inform my lived experience.
Just let that breathe for a moment. I remember doing my Enneagram. I've done it a few times and confronting that fear. And actually, if anybody's interested in a deeper dive, Scott and I did a couple of shows on this where we actually went through a lot more detail each of these fears and how they play out, and you know how you can mitigate them as well. So when I looked at my fears as being 7 and 8, they're kind of two dominant aspects, and they are incredibly difficult to confront. But also when you do, there's a joy in that because you can see the pattern playing out. And the thing that you can do to mitigate, to offset that, is actually very liberating. So I think the truth of this, and I think one of the things that we should just call out in this moment here is that there's a whole counter voice in the world around all of these psychometrics, calling them out as akin to sort of horoscopes and so on, and that you can see yourself in any kind of description of personality types and say, yeah, that's me, and they've got me, and so on. So it might be worth just pausing for a moment and reflecting on that, because my take on it is that if something helps you to have a conversation a meaningful conversation and get to some form of self-understanding. It may not be because, you know, we are already identified there's lots of things going on here. You can't summarize a human being through a psychometric program, especially as it's self-reported. But if you can get some insight into yourself that unlocks a truth and a greater degree of self-awareness, that's incredible. So just give us a sense of your take on this.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you brought this up. And it's important to note, you know, the Enneagram system wasn't developed by some uneducated individual who doesn't know what they're talking about. This is the work and refinement of multiple PhD level psychologists who built this system, right? It has origins much deeper than that, but it's a sense-making system, right? This is the sort of patterns that show up enough, right? So yes, it's not everything I'm describing will be 100% true of any individual, but their patterns and motivations and fears and desires that show up consistently enough. And the system is, you know, it doesn't just show you a linear progression of nine. It's actually around this. Enneagram means nine, and the gram means picture. It's a picture of these nine personalities and how they relate to one another. And again, it was built and designed and refined by psychologists, and they use it. You know, those psychologists who know it always say, gosh, this saves me so much time with my patients. Because if I can understand, you know, without us spending 2 years to finally get to the fact that, oh, you're motivated because you feel worthless separate from what you achieve, now we can actually get somewhere. We can almost start there, you know, you can sort of save time. So I agree. I don't think anybody should just believe it. This isn't some kind of cultish kind of thing where you just buy into it, you know, hook, line, and sinker. But the roots of the Enneagram are really strong in the psychology profession. And I think that's important for people to know.
So, you know, we are constantly bombarded with this idea of growth and open mindsets and so on. And we have talked a lot about the counter to that, which is the defensive mindset and how emotions form that and how that can then become inured into these fears and become a way of thinking about things. Can we talk about that for a moment? Because what I didn't know about the Enneagram is that it reveals the nine personality specific defense mechanisms that will interfere with a person developing or sustaining that kind of openness to the world. Can we tell us a little bit about those defense mechanisms and how they're attached to each of the types?
Yeah. I go into a deep dive in the book. That's a really important piece. So thanks for asking it. Cause you know, we do a lot of work with the open and growth mindsets and talk about defensiveness. And when you have a room full of people, we can talk about it in a very general way, and they may not understand the ways in which they themselves are getting trapped in defensiveness, as you're pointing to. So just as a sort of, I guess, teaser for anybody that's interested in reading the book, type ones use the defense mechanism of reaction formation. So we talked about them a bit throughout this conversation, believing that anger is not an acceptable emotion, they use the defensive reaction formation to turn anger into a more pleasant and acceptable emotion. So if you ever talk to somebody who's giving you a big smile, but behind their eyes, you're kind of, why do I think you want to hit me in the face right now? Right? You've got this sort of, like, I don't believe the smile, right? And that's reaction formation, right? Twos use the defense mechanism of repression. So we talked about how they like to go out towards other people to help please and, you know, give in some way and overly focus on the experience of other people. And in so doing, they repress their own wants and needs. And so much of what a two is doing actually is looking for you to meet their needs without them having to ask for it directly. Because if they ask for it directly, you might directly reject them. So they repress what they, from conscious awareness, what they really want, and they get really subtle with what they, how they try to get their needs met. Threes use identification. So they overly identify with what the expectations are of everybody in each room that they're in. And then they subtly shape shift to represent what good and great and successful would look like in that room. So they become a bit chameleon-like, and they over-identify with these different chameleon-like strategies and deceive themselves into thinking that they're being authentic when they're not. Fours use introjection. So feeling deficient themselves or flawed in some way, they interject the emotions and experiences of other people around them and kind of make them their own lived experience. Fives use isolation. So fives get stuck in, that fear of being overwhelmed that I mentioned a while ago. They will isolate and retreat up into the attics of their mind to try to process and make sense of the world. And so they don't show up the way they need to. Sixes, with the core fear, which for them is just fear itself. They fear so many different things. They project onto other people and experiences things that they can't process or tolerate or accept in themselves. So they sort of outsource their fear onto others. Sevens use rationalization. So we talked about how they are the consummate reframers of any negatives into positives, most likely subject into confirmation bias.
I think that's a really powerful skill, by the way.
Yeah.
Is that you? You're a seven, John.
might have something to do with it, but yeah.
So they rationalize this behavior of theirs as a way to keep them from having to face unpleasant realities. Eights use denial, right? They deny their vulnerability until they really do the work and understanding of vulnerability is actually a strength, which is hard for eights to accept. I've coached many eights and they're like, I just don't understand why anybody would want to be vulnerable. Like, I don't understand, what do I get out of that? It's like really hard for them to understand. And nines use the defense mechanism of narcotization. So we talked about how nines so fear being cut off from important people in their lives that they go to sleep to their own agendas to merge with the will and wants of everybody else. And this is both personally and professionally. And as a strategy for keeping their own anger at bay and staying asleep to anything that would upset the sense of peace they covet, they narcotize, which means, you know, they are more likely to, whether it's routines or what have you, they're, you know, let's use things like, you know, sitting down and watching all of Netflix or, you know, going through a tub of ice cream or anything that sort of can kind of keep them from having to face these things that they're doing. So these nine specific defense mechanisms are what I talked about, how the rigidity of the personality is so strong and so trying to defend the essence of who we are underneath, that sort of part of ourselves that we buried away to protect it, that we have to sort of be able to unpick and understand how these defenses are going to keep surfacing. They're going to keep coming back. It's not one and done, right? But being mindful of that, you can start to see when you're closing off and you're not opening yourself up to change.
Well, I mean, that's fascinating in the sense of, you know, more and more organizations completely from top to bottom are having to adapt in faster and faster cycles, and all the defensive reactions that you're talking about there are the things that we see every day in terms of how people avoid change or deny it or suppress the things they need to do to respond to it. And so I'm just wondering in your work whether you found a way of, I mean, that the analysis helps you to get to one level. How do you get people to accept that? I mean, you talked about vulnerability being difficult for certain people to accept immediately. Are there quick ways to help people to respond to this and start on the journey of being more open to change?
Quick ways? No. Most people start working with the Enneagram when I've talked to them is when they acknowledge that their strategies for life aren't working the way that they used to, right? As Carl Jung roughly said, I'll paraphrase, you know, what works for us in the morning of life will work against you in the afternoon. And when some of these strategies are failing and you start going, gosh, you know, I'm looking in the rearview mirror of my life and I'm seeing these little fender benders and issues, then something's got to shift. For me, I shared my story of what had to shift. I mean, that was a big alarm. Some people won't go through something that significant. And when you recognize that your strategy might not be working, at least not as completely as it did, just open yourself up to self-discovery. Just start the journey of finding out more about this thing that we call personality and all the ways that it has served you in life. It you have it because it worked, and then, you know, it doesn't always work, and it stopped working as effectively. And then I think along the way of self-discovery, through learning more about your type, any practices that start to help you reintegrate body, heart, and mind, I would say you could start right away, right? This is similar to some of the mindset work we've been talking about in your work, John. But, you know, body scans and, you know, meditation and yoga and anything that you know, interoceptive sensitivity practices, all of those things are critically important for starting the work of realigning because of these three intelligences. And then I think the last thing I would say is, you know, once you start to learn more about your tendencies, try to create more space for slowing down enough to observe and recognize what's happening. So just stop and then kind of notice what's happening. When I say stop, I mean, especially when you feel like you're going to, you know, react out of your conditioning, that sort of automation that happens when you say something to me and I just have this reaction, internal reaction, stopping long enough to then kind of notice, what's the story I'm telling myself right now? You know, is that story objectively true? What am I feeling? What's behind that feeling? What's my body telling me? Like all these things that we keep talking about on this show, but from a lens of personality, you know, specificity. And then you can kind of get curious about it. And the one thing I will say too, be incredibly self-compassionate in your curiosity, right? Don't look at these things and go, because the Enneagram is going to reveal to you some unflattering things, but it's meant to be confronted with self-friendship, and you're never going to, you know, shame your way into change. That's counterproductive to change. Like, just get curious. Just stay curious long enough to be able to question the stories that you hold.
You use this really, I liked it, it's a lovely phrase in your book, and you talk very early on about setting off on a never-ending path of self-discovery and the reality that there is no self-awareness station. I love that station where you finally arrive. And I just wondered, based on this work and obviously the importance of this book, I wondered how you'd come to make sense of that for yourself in terms of your next sort of journey of self-awareness. Where, you know, what next for Scott Allender and this piece of work?
It's a good question. I feel like such a youth in this process in a way. You know, I'm writing about it, but I still feel, you know, just early days of self-discovery in so many ways. And I do point that out because I think it's easy to make a bit of progress early on in this kind of journey, and then inevitably something will trigger you. You will fall back into old patterns and you might think, oh, phooey, Enneagram was interesting for a minute, but it doesn't really work. It only works if you keep doing the work, right? It's this book is an invitation to set you on to whatever work that you need to do specifically. And so I thank you for bringing that up because it's a journey, and that's the whole point. You know, for me, I just want to keep sitting down with people and helping them on this path, you know. Anytime, you know, you sit in front of somebody that through the coaching conversation and the whole process, you know, they have that any kind of light bulb moment that you get to see in their eyes, and then, you know, later when you follow up and realize that they're continuing the path, it's incredibly rewarding. So I hope that I continue to have these opportunities to contribute to the conversation in some positive way, hopefully.
So Scott, I think we've kind of run out of time today. I think anybody listening to this will be inspired by both your authenticity and your vulnerability in your journey to understand this. And your book, The Enneagram of Emotional Intelligence, is very personal, but it's also incredibly practical, and it brings together a lot of stuff in a very easy, digestible. You don't need to be anything. You don't need to know anything about the Enneagram to quickly understand it. And it brings lots of different concepts and insights together. So, thoroughly recommend it. Not just because you are a friend, but because it is a brilliant book.
Thank you. You
deserve great success with it. And I just want to thank you for, you know, sharing why you wrote it and the kind of direction of travel it's brought you on. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for being willing to do this, and I appreciate your kind words. Emma, I can't close us out today, so, you know, because I'm a guest. So do you wanna do the...
So don't forget, folks, the world is evolving. Are you?